Wow. We made it to Friday, 5 p.m. I don't know. It seemed like it was a four-day week for most people, I think, with Labor Day, Monday being a holiday this week. But, man.
I find it makes it all the harder when you have a short week.
Doesn't it?
In quotations.
You got to get 5 days of work into those 4 days. You know, it's kind of what happens. So it just weighs on you. Anyway, it's behind us now. It's time, 5 p.m. It's happy hour. Enjoy yourselves. But sit back and relax and hear some great music. I definitely have some great music lined up for you because it's 5 p.m. and it's time for the How Music Changed series. I'm Tom Ryan, your host for the next hour. That's my lovely wife and co-host, Teddy Morales Ryan, who you heard earlier, running the board and taking care of the details here in the studio. And what we've been doing for quite a while now with the How Music Changed series is picking a topic and going deep as we can. Our latest topic, person of interest, is Billie Holiday. We started 2 weeks ago covering the life and music of Billie Holiday. Today is part three of that series, where we cover the years 1936, 1937, thereabouts. As we're playing the music, at least that's the time for the music. For filler between the tracks, I am reading from Billie Holiday's book called Lady Sings the Blues. Now, I'm reading it in order of how she wrote it, more or less. I'm editing, of course. I'm not reading the entire book. But she jumps around in time a little bit, and that's okay. It's her book. But I do want to keep the music in chronological order. So anyway, since we're now here in like the mid-30s, I mean, these early years, in my opinion, represent some of Billie's best because they catch her at a time when she was able to enjoy her life and also like the good things that showbiz had to offer her. For the first two shows, we heard nothing but the hardships that she was going through in order to get to become a singer and get recognition. That's where she is now at this point in time where we're going to start today. Things weren't perfect, but they most certainly were looking up. So I'm going to let her tell a story about what was happening at her point in life around this time. And it's a story that when I read it, I had to stop and reread it about four or five times because I found it to be like amazing. And it can't be just hearsay if Billie wrote it and published it. But I don't really ever remember hearing anything about this until I read it. So I'm just going to read it to you. Back then, jam sessions were really the thing. Every morning after I finished working, there was always a big jam session on somewhere. Cats like Benny Goodman and Harry James would come up after they finished their gigs in the big radio studio orchestras. They would sit in with the greatest guys around. Roy Eldridge, Lester Young, Benny Webster. They were all friends of mine. But Benny Goodman was somebody special among the musicians I hung out with. We'd get together once a week regularly at those jam sessions and spend a few hours together. This got to be a big deal, mainly because my mother was so strict with me and didn't want me running around with white boys. And also, Benny's sister, Ethel, was his manager then. She had eyes for Benny going to the top as a band leader, and she didn't want him to wreck his chances for making it by being seen with a little black chick. Benny was a nice cat, never a drag, and we used to outwit my mother and his sister in order to spend some time together. This went on for a long time, right up to the time I fell in love, but good and hard, for the first time. It wasn't until that happened that I knew what had got on before was nothing but fooling around. Sure, he was a musician too. He played piano, great piano. He played me for a while. He was almost old enough to be my father, and he was married, had two or three kids. It was the first time I was ever wooed, courted, chased after. He made me feel like a woman. He was patient and loving. He knew what I was scared about, and he knew how to smooth my fears away. But beyond that, no good could come of it. In fact, at one point, I was taking it all so seriously, it came mighty close to becoming tragic. So, at least she had a very strong friendship with Benny Goodman. And it was a relationship that was strong enough that she only had to, like, basically let it go when she found that she was falling in love with somebody. But she mentions in the very beginning the jam sessions as being the things that were bringing them all together. So that's where I want to start. A song that, if you had a jam session, the first thing that musicians are going to want to do is either play a blues where everybody has a pretty good idea about exactly what the structure is going to be, or you want to pick a very famous song that everybody's familiar with. That's exactly what this one is. It's a Gershwin song, one of his most famous, a song that Billy made quite famous herself, her rendering of Summertime.
Cotton is high. Oh, your dad is rich and your ma is good looking. So hush, little baby, don't you cry. One of these mornings you're going to rise up singing, then you'll spread your wings and you'll take the sky. But till that morning, there's nothing can harm you.
Gershwin's Summertime, right there. Now, we hit something which is a bit of an earmark in Billy's life, a song called Billy's Blues, a song that Billy herself wrote. Turns out that what had happened was she was probably working on it in her head a little bit, and she came into the recording session, and they were scheduled to record something different, but the band didn't like that song that they were scheduled to record, and Billy just suggested, let's try my song. And they did, and everybody loved it, and it became actually a staple for Billy in her live recordings. In fact, it's one of the most popular songs in her live, in the live performances that she's ever done. In fact, there's even a version from 1954 that stretched out for over 10 minutes. We'll see what happens when we get that far in 1954, if we can cover it again. But here is the original recording of Billy's Blues. Mm-hmm. have it. Billy's Own, Billy's Blues. All right, now I would be up to what in Billy's book would be chapter 5 called Getting Some Fun Out of Life. It wasn't long before I became a radio and movie actress on the side. Shelton Brooks, the songwriter, author of Some of These Days, had heard me sing. He was making a few bucks in radio and he thought I could play some of the parts in a show he worked on. It was one of those daytime soap opera serials, True Love Story or True Romances or something like that. Anyway, when you worked, it was in the mornings, so it didn't interfere with my night work. Shelton was playing two or three parts on the same show. Sometimes he'd be both the butler and the husband, so we fixed it up for me to double as the wife and the maid. It was worth 15 bucks a day when you worked. And you know, those serials about the troubles of Mary could drag on and on. Those writers could make one little quarrel last for weeks. For 15 bucks a day, this was a big deal. Don't forget, this is the radio. Shelton must have been 50 then. That would make him older than God by now. But they still don't come any sharper. He still plays a great blues on the piano, and he can make you laugh your sides apart. With all this acting experience behind me, Shelton thought I was ready for a crack at the movies. Not Hollywood, just Astoria, Long Island. He got me a part out there playing mob scenes in a picture with Paul Robeson. From that, I got a real part in a short featuring Duke Ellington. It was a musical with a little story to it, and it gave me a chance to sing a song, a real weird and pretty blues number. That was the good thing about the part. Now, we played that song last week in part two, that Duke Ellington song. She's right. It is a very weird and pretty blues number. It's called Saddest Tale. It wasn't the best quality recording because it was taken from a film, but I thought it was historically relevant, and that's where we were chronologically. So if you want to hear that tune, go to American Hit Radio or AmericanHitNetwork.com. And just look for the Billie Holiday series, which is going to be right there on the homepage, and you'll be able to hear that song on part two of the series. Now, Billie talking about that part, she said that the good thing about it was the song. The rough part, of course, was that I had to play a chippy. Opposite me, there was a comedian who will kill me because I can't remember his name. He played my pimp or my sweetheart. He was just supposed to knock me around. He knocked me down about 20 times the first day of shooting. Each time I took a fall, I landed on the hard old floor, painted to look like sidewalk. And there was nothing to break my fall except the flesh on my bones. The second morning when I showed up at the studio, I was so sore I couldn't even think about breaking my falls. I must have hit that hard painted pavement about 50 times before the man hollered cut. I saw a little bit of this epic one time at the studio, but that was all. Mom, of course, thought I was going to be a big movie star, and she told everybody to watch for the picture. I don't know if anybody else saw it, but we never did. It was just a short subject, something they filled in when they couldn't get Mickey Mouse. We'd have had to hire a private detective to find out where the hell I was playing. Let's play one more track from Billie Holiday now. This is awesome. Jerome Kern song, again, recorded in 1936. She'd recorded again in 1955. So again, we'll see what happens when we get up to that part of the series. But here is the early version of Billie Holiday singing A Fine Romance. Romance, you won't nestle
you're calmer than the seas in the Arctic Ocean. At least they flap their fins to express emotion. Oh, fine romance with no quarrels, with no insults and all morals. I've never mussed the crease in your blue serge pants. I never get the chance. This is a fine romance.
Now, I didn't mention this, but that track was credited to Billie Holiday and her orchestra. I did mention last week that she had got a record deal where she was going to be able to get her own name on the label as the star artist. And that song is one of them that did feature her as Billie Holiday and her orchestra. But she was still working as a vocalist for other bands, most commonly Teddy Wilson and his orchestra, with people like Ben Webster and Gene Krupa in the band, and of course Teddy Wilson on piano. And that's where we're going to be going now. She's also involved with a bunch of bands that she actually didn't get to do too much recording with. But first, let's play this track from Teddy Wilson and his orchestra. This is from October 21st, 1936. A really great Cole Porter song with Billie Holiday. This is like where you begin to feel that she is so confident in what she's doing that she's even ready to play with the melody line of the song. She doesn't have to worry about singing it exactly the way that Cole Porter wrote it. She's confident enough in her own skin and in her own talent to sing it the way that she's feeling it. And I think it gives it a tremendous amount of emotion. It's called Easy to Love. you have it. Another classic from, of course, Billie Holiday. We're covering Billie and some of her best recordings, in my opinion. That was Easy to Love, Easy to Like as well. Now, the chronology of the stories are not going to be perfectly in sync with the chronology of the music. I think I explained why, because Billie moves around a little bit, and she might jump forward and then jump back. And anyway, I just want to tell this story about how when she got hooked up with the Count Basie band, we're not going to get to those tracks probably till late in part four, if not part five. But she starts it right here in chapter six, where she goes, "Things are looking up. I joined Count Basie's band to make a little money and see the world. For almost 2 years, I didn't see anything but the inside of a Blue Goose bus, and I never got to send home a quarter. I had started at the log cabin for $18 a week. By the time I opened at Clark Monroe's Uptown House, I was getting $35 when I got it. Half the time, Clark would say he was short and come up with $15 or $20. When I asked for the rest of my money, he would start telling me how much I'd get from this one and that one in tips. One night, a man had given me $50 in the joint for nothing at all, and Clark would remind me of that every time I asked for the rest of it that he owed me. I had spent some of my good loot trying to make the joint go. After my record with Teddy Wilson started moving, I had a big cardboard sign painted on with my picture on it for Clark to put out front to help bring people in. It began to be a drag. I was getting disgusted. After I'd closed at the Apollo, I was booked into a French joint in Montreal. This was my first date outside New York, and I enjoyed it. I tasted champagne there for the first time, hated it, and I still do. But I liked the people. I met a wonderful Canadian boy up there. He used to tell me scotch would hurt my voice and try to get me on champagne. But I used to drink champagne with him at a table and then sneak into the kitchen for some scotch. He was a fine fellow, but his family caught on to what was going on and they broke it up, but quick. Anyway, John Hammond had brought the Basie band out of Kansas City and was backing their first tour. When they opened in Pittsburgh, in the biggest hotel in town, they died like a dog. Flopped. Hammond decided what they needed was a girl vocalist, so he put up some financing along with Willard Alexander of MCA and asked me to join the band at $14 a day. Stop there. Hard to make money that way, isn't it? I believe we're up to where I want to play this Jerome Kern and Dorothy Field song. Again, still from about October of 1936. Billie's interpretation of The Way You Look Tonight. Thank you.
but you're lovely, with your smile so warm and your cheeks so soft. There is nothing for me but to love you just the way you look tonight. With each word your tenderness grows, tearing my fear apart. And that laugh that wrinkles your nose touches my foolish heart. Lovely, never, never change. Keep that breathless charm. Won't you please arrange it? 'Cause I love you just the way you look tonight.
I mentioned this, I believe, last week, but what's interesting is how the arrangements stretch out with the band doing a very long intro. The singer comes in, plays through the verse and the chorus, and then it goes back to the band to end it. This is the way that music was done in the 30s. Just thought I'd mention that. Let me remind you that you're listening to 90.3 WHPC, WHPCHD in Garden City, New York. I'm Tom Ryan with my wife, Heidi Morales-Ryan, behind the boards, and we are covering the life of and music of Billie Holiday.
I guess I'm not your lovely wife anymore.
Oh, I think I say that so often, you might be tired of hearing it, aren't you?
Oh, never.
Never? Oh, my very lovely wife. My beautiful wife, Heidi Morales-Ryan. And right now we are on part three of the series. We've got a long way to go. But I don't want to skip anything that's not great. I mean, listen, I'm not going to play everything. In fact, I'm playing what I would say amounts to about maybe a third or a quarter of her output. That's still a lot when you put it all together. And this next track, again, is Teddy Wilson and his orchestra. The band is, by the way, it's Mouse Randolph on trumpet, Vito Musso on clarinet, the fabulous Ben Webster on tenor sax, Teddy Wilson, of course, on piano, Alan Royce on guitar, and the legendary Milt Hinton on bass with Gene Krupa on drums. And guess who's singing lead vocals? That's Billie Holiday, who's now going to be singing Who Loves You.
Thank you.
in the swing, right? Whew, awesome. Who Loves You? From November of 1936. I'll get back to Billy's story now about being on the bus with Count Basie's band. I wasn't even getting my $35 a week at the Uptown House. And I guess from one trip to Montreal, I thought traveling would be one big romance like that. So $14 a day sounded real great. Nobody bothered to tell me I'd have to travel 500 to 600 miles on a hot or cold raggedy-ass Blue Goose bus, that it would cost me $2 or $3 a night for a room, that by the time I was through having my hair fixed and gowns pressed, to say nothing of paying for pretty clothes to wear, I'd end up with about $1.50 a day. Out of that, I had to eat and drink and send home some loot to Mom. Whenever I had a couple of bucks, it was always so little I was ashamed to send it home. So I would give it to Lester Young to invest. I hoped he could shoot enough dice to parlay it into a bill big enough that I didn't have to feel ashamed to send home. The first time out, we had been riding for 3 months, and neither Lester nor I had a dime. Both of us were actually hungry. Jimmy Rushing, the blues singing Mr. 5x5, was always the only one who had any loot. We went to him once and asked him real nice for a buck to buy a couple of hamburgers. He wouldn't give us nothing but a lecture on how he saved his money and how we petered ours away. This might be a good time for me to talk about Teddy Wilson Orchestra. First of all, personnel changed this time around. The only people who were in the previous band, Ben Webster, Teddy Wilson himself, and Alan Royce, are still there. But Jonah Jones is now on trumpet. Benny Goodman is on clarinet. John Kirby is the bass player, and Cozy Cole is the drummer. And it seems appropriate, after hearing Billy's story, that we play Pennies from Heaven. Thank you. Song written by Johnny Burke and Arthur Johnson. I guess you know that one, Pennies from Heaven. Now back to Billy's story about being on that bus and not and feeling like she's starving to death. When we were on the bus coming back to New York from West Virginia, I couldn't stand the thought of coming home to Mom broke. I had $4 when that crap game started on the bus floor. "You're not shooting these four," I told Lester. "I'm shooting these myself." I got on my knees, and the first time up, it was a 7. Everybody hollered at me that the bus had swerved and made me shoot it over. Up came 11. I picked up the $4 right there and won the next 3 pots before someone said something about comfort. I thought they said, "What do you come for?" I said, "I come for any damn thing you come for." I didn't know the lingo, but I knew Lester did. So I told him I'd do the shooting and he could be the lookout man. I was on my knees in the bottom of that bus from West Virginia to New York, a few 100 miles in about 12 hours. When we pulled up in front of the Woodside Hotel, everybody was broke and crying. I was filthy dirty and had holes in the knees of my stockings, but I had $1,600 and some change. I gave some of the cats in the band enough loot to eat with and for car fare, but not rushing. I didn't give him back a dime. I took what was left and split on uptown to Mom's. When I walked in, she looked at me and liked to die that I was so dirty and beat up. I just waited for her to say something, and she did. "I'll bet you ain't got a dime either," Mom said. I took that money, over $1,000, and threw it on the floor. She salted a lot of it away, and later it became the nest egg she used to start her own little restaurant, Mom Holidays, something that she always wanted. This might be a good time to play the song called "That's Life," I guess.
Thank you.
Life, I guess, was the name of that track. Now back to Billy's story about being on the road with Count Basie. Keep in mind now, in 1930s, when you're on the road with the band, you're not recording. You're on the road. You're playing in different venues every single night. You're sleeping in cheap hotels. Well, she'll tell you the story. Basie did a wonderful job with the band, but he just wasn't his own boss. He was just out of Kansas City. A big booking agency was backing him and trying to sell the band. We'd play a whole string of riffraff joints, rough Negro dance halls in the South where people were sneaking in corn whiskey from across the tracks, and then, boom, in the middle of this grind, we would be booked into some white hotel. We didn't have the right uniforms, clothes, equipment. The cats in the band didn't even have the right horns they needed. We'd all be beat from traveling thousands of miles with no sleep, no rehearsal, no preparation, and yet we'd be expected to be real great. After each crisis on the road, we'd end up back in New York. Then there'd be a big strategy meeting, figuring what was wrong with straightening things out. I was accused of romancing everyone in the band, and this was leading to dissension. This was a damn lie, and I said so. I wasn't doing anything with anybody in the band except one cat, and not very often with him at that. The truth was, I was scared of the cats in the band because they were messing with too many chicks on the road. Living on the road with a band, nobody had time to sleep alone, let alone with somebody. At night, as Lester used to say, we'd pull into town, pay $2 to $4 for a room, shave and take a long look at the bed, go play the gig, come back and look at the bed again, and then get on the bus. We'd get so fed up with it one time, Lester and me, we threatened to resign and ended up getting a raise. I got raised to $15 a day, and Lester got boosted to $18.50. I thought this was just too marvelous for words. I wish that that song was the next thing I could play, but it happens to be this one called I Can't Give You Anything But Love. Listen to Ben Webster as he closes out the end of the chorus. I just love listening to Ben Webster. something about the voice of Billie Holiday and that warm tone of Ben Webster on the saxophone is just perfect, the way they sound together. Now, we finished 1936, and I was going to roll into 1937 for part four, but I think we could squeeze in one more here, of course, today while we're at it. I'll let Billy tell a little bit of a story here about a song that we won't be playing for a while, but I think she just is mentioning this for reasons of how she's able to ad-lib. When I did Night and Day, I had never even seen that song before in my life. I don't read music either. I just walked in, Teddy Wilson played it for me, and I did it. With artists like Lester, Don Byas, Benny Carter, Coleman Hawkins, something was always happening. No amount of preparation today is any match for them. In the old days, if we were one side short on a date, someone would say, "Try the blues in A-flat," and tell me, "Go as far as you can, honey." I'd stand up there and make up my words as I went along. That's the way that they were doing it in 1936 and 1937. And you'll probably be hearing some of that on some of these tracks. Most of what we're hearing, though, are relatively popular songs that are part of the, the songbook, which we did a series on this whole thing, this How Music Changed series, quite a while back. We did a series on the Great American Songbook. If you want to check out our older series, please check out our website, AmericanHitNetwork.com. There is so much there, so much rich history for you to dig into. Contemporary stuff, old stuff, going all the way back to pre-Louis Armstrong. And this is us actually getting sort of contemporary with the old stuff coming up to Billie Holiday. But with that, let's play one more track and we'll say goodbye. Billie Holiday and her orchestra once again. This time the track is "I've Got My Love to Keep Me Warm." Take care, folks. We'll see you next Friday.
The snow is snowing, the wind is blowing, but I can weather the a worse December. Just watch those icicles fall. What do I care if icicles fall? I've got my love to keep me warm. Off with my cold. I'm burning with love. My heart's on fire. The flame grows higher.